Tonight on Standing Room Only, 9/11. A Hoosier whistleblower examines the official conspiracy theory. Did 9/11 really happen the way we think it did? Not according to Kevin Ryan. Kevin is a chemist and former site manager at Underwriters Laboratories in South Bend. During the post-9/11 investigation, Kevin questioned discrepancies between UL's test results on steel components from the World Trade Center and the official account of the building's collapse. Days later, he was fired. Now he works tirelessly to debunk what he calls the government's conspiracy theory of the 9/11 tragedy. Ryan spoke to a Bloomington audience as a representative of Scholars for 9/11 Truth, a nonpartisan association of faculty, students, and scholars dedicated to exposing falsehoods and revealing truths behind 9/11. The group's members are convinced their research proves the current administration has been dishonest about what happened in New York and Washington, D.C. They believe that the government not only permitted 9/11 to occur, but may have even orchestrated these events to facilitate its political agenda. 9/11, A Hoosier Whistleblower Examines the Official Conspiracy Theory, featuring Kevin Ryan, was recorded on location for WFHB at the Monroe County Public Library on Wednesday, March 15, 2006.
So understanding the official conspiracy theory is very important. It's important for two reasons. One, because it's redefining our futures, and two, because it's false. And those two facts together should be really important to all Americans. Without the official conspiracy theory, there would be no war on terror. So really, the 9/11 wars, which came as a result of 9/11, are a huge investment related directly to the official conspiracy theory. So far in just Afghanistan and Iraq, I think that most people know that in total, 2,600 Americans have been killed. Nearly 20,000 overall have been killed or wounded. And over 30,000 civilians have been killed, including children. And the costs financially are staggering, $300 billion and counting. We're also redefining our values with this theory. Lately, Americans have begun to accept things like indefinite imprisonment without charges, torture. They've incorporated the Patriot Act again, and spying on Americans is now acceptable. We're really giving up what it means to be an American using this official conspiracy theory. If you turn on the network news even today, and I've done this a few times, any given day, you'll hear 9/11 repeated several times. All federal programs outside of defense and homeland security have become low priorities. Public perception is affected on every level, and our national debt is skyrocketing. Our government, including the 9/11 Commission, has told us that there will be another terrorist attack, and you can imagine there will be another war as a result. General Tommy Franks, who led the war in Iraq, has said that if there is another terrorist attack, there will be a suspension of the Constitution. I'd like to talk about Iran just for a minute. Iran, of the 190 independent countries in the world, is now the one country that we fear the most. Of the 190 independent countries in the world, it is also the number one country for proven reserves of oil and natural gas in combination. So I'd like to get to a very important reason why this official conspiracy theory is redesigning our futures. We're wasting precious time and resources on these 9/11 wars that are a result of this theory that we could be using to pursue new solutions for the end of cheap oil. Global oil production has peaked, according to a lot of experts. U.S. natural gas production has peaked. And these things are so important that they will have vast implications for world politics, agriculture, and economic stability. These are the real issues that we need to be dealing with. We need new ways of dealing with money because our industrial societies and our financial systems were built on the assumption of continual growth that relied on the readily available cheap fossil fuels. And we need new solutions for environmental problems. And now we're not working on any of these things, really, because we're investing so much in the official conspiracy theory. So again, the official conspiracy theory is equivalent to the war on terror. And the official conspiracy theory is represented by two reports today. One is the 9/11 Commission report, and the other is the NIST World Trade Center report. The 9/11 Commission, their mission was to provide the fullest possible account of the events surrounding 9/11. Additionally, they claim to have done exacting research on the subject. But one thing a lot of people don't know is that research was totally controlled, as was the report by the executive director of the commission, a man named Philip Zelikow, who was essentially a member of the Bush administration. He was a member of the first Bush administration. He wrote a book with Condoleezza Rice, and he continues to be an advisor to this administration. So essentially, the 9/11 Commission report is a product of the Bush administration. The NIST World Trade Center report, their mission was to explain why and how three tall buildings collapsed all on the same day when it's never happened before. So before we get started looking at first the 9/11 Commission report, I think we need to realize again that we have a decision to make. Everybody does. We either believe that, on the one hand, the investments we've made in this official conspiracy theory weigh more than the conspiracy theory itself, or the conspiracy theory weighs more than all those investments. I also would say that if the official conspiracy theory is false, it's a greater crime than the crime of 9/11. So this is essentially the official conspiracy theory as presented by the 9/11 Commission. 19 fanatically religious Arab Muslims totally outfoxed and overpowered the entire U.S. military and intelligence apparatus, as well as the security systems of several airports, and then performing expert aerial maneuvers, flew several hijacked aircraft into buildings and crashed another one in Pennsylvania. These terrorists were acting on behalf of Osama bin Laden and no other foreign or domestic agencies because they hate America. They were able to accomplish this because of deep institutional failings within the U.S. government. Now, in looking at this first part of the conspiracy theory, I'm going to draw heavily on research done by one Scholars for Truth member, and that is David Ray Griffin. His book is The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. So we're going to step through this bit by bit. 19 fanatically religious Muslims is how it starts. And it doesn't start out well because at least six of them were reported to be alive after 9/11, and this was not investigated by the 9/11 Commission. Some of them were anything but devout Muslims, as they were known to enjoy alcohol, drugs, gambling, and lap dances, which are not the activities of devout Muslims. Additionally, they left some suspicious clues. For example, I believe Muhammad Atta's passport crashed into the building, survived the intense fires, survived the collapse of the building, and fell unharmed on the street for us to find. Additionally, flight manuals, copies of the Quran, and personal notes were left for us to find. And Seymour Hersh, the reporter, stated that a former high-level intelligence official had told him that whatever trail was left deliberately. We need to look a little closer at the claim that these people were still alive, because that's very important. Apparently, Waleed al-Shari was interviewed by a London newspaper and then, as reported by the Associated Press, spoke on September 22nd to the U.S. Embassy in Morocco. Ahmed al-Nami told the British newspaper The Telegraph that I have never even heard of Pennsylvania. Saeed al-Ghandi was interviewed by several newspapers and reported by the BBC to have been in Tunis for 11 months, including September 11th. Mohan el-Sheri, Salam al-Hazmi, and Abdul Aziz al-Omari were all reported alive and well in Saudi Arabia by the Saudi embassy in Washington, and al-Omari visited the U.S. consulate in Jeddah to demand an explanation. And these are the same people that are listed in the 9/11 Commission report. So we'll go on. These 19 hijackers totally outfoxed and overpowered the entire U.S. military intelligence apparatus. But it's clear that some within the FBI appeared to have advanced knowledge of the attacks. For example, John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown, and several Pentagon officials were warned by the FBI not to fly on or about 9/11. Additionally, Attorney David Shippers from Chicago has several FBI agents as clients who told him exact details, dates, times, places of the attacks. And he tried to pass that on to John Ashcroft for 6 weeks prior to the attacks without any response. Now, David Shippers is well known in the Republican circles, David Ray Griffin has noted, because he impeached Bill Clinton. He's the prosecutor that impeached Bill Clinton. So they know him very well. Additionally, profits from very unusual stock trades in companies that were related to 9/11, American Airlines, United Airlines, and Morgan Dean Stanley Witter, who occupied 22 floors of the World Trade Center, point to insider knowledge. Additionally, the Secret Service appeared to know that the president was not a target. I think we all know that Bush stayed in the elementary school a little bit long. He actually stayed there for 30 minutes. And then it was 20 minutes after that before they left that town on Air Force One and unescorted. There was no fighter jets escorting them. So 50 minutes elapsed, and apparently the president was known not to be a target. There's a lot of other evidence that the FBI knew what was going on. And this story with Colleen Rowley should be coming up again. In August of 2001, Rowley's Minneapolis FBI office requested permission to search the computer of Zacharias Moussaoui because they believed he might fly something into the World Trade Center. This request was not only denied, but FBI headquarters actually changed the evidence file, downplaying Moussaoui's connection to Al-Qaeda. A congressional report later said the FBI headquarters' new file on Moussaoui was patently false. Rowley did write a memo that became famous. She ended up on Time magazine's cover. The 9/11 Commission did not interview her and called this dispute a simple difference of opinion. And there's been articles in the paper recently. Moussaoui's now the government's only convict for the crimes, and he may be put to death for failure to act, believe it or not. But who really failed to act is the question. Another FBI whistleblower who has still got a story to tell us, her name is Sybil Edmonds. She was an FBI translator. She accused the FBI of intentionally failing to translate documents relating to certain foreign governments. She was fired for writing a letter about this to the Department of Justice and later was gagged by John Ashcroft. She has since stated that she has considerable knowledge of wrongdoing within the U.S. government and suggested they knew in advance about the 9/11 attacks. And none of her 3.5-hour testimony to the 9/11 Commission was included in their report. Now, Sybil is ready to speak, I understand. She started a new organization called National Security Whistleblowers. And if you search for her on the Internet, you can sign her petition, give her a little support. The 9/11 Commission report did briefly mention one or two of these war games that were going on, but actually, apparently, there were five of them going on the very day of September 11th. Some involved hijacked airliners, insertion of fake radar blips, and pulling fighter jets away from the northeast. Some of these were live fly exercises with real airplanes, and obviously NORAD and FAA and others were affected. What did the 9/11 Commission do with this? They asked the generals who were in charge, who apparently failed us deeply, if that had any effect on their work, and they said no, and that was the end of it. We have to ask ourselves, how many of these kinds of exercises go on every day? Is there five every day? I doubt there is. It seems to be an incredible coincidence. To go on with whether or not we were totally outfoxed and overpowered, the military story changed several times with regard to whether or not jets were scrambled. For the first 3 days, they said that no jets were scrambled until after the buildings were hit. Now, certainly they should have known. A week later, though, they did say that jets were scrambled, actually. They were just too far away. And apparently some of them were traveling at 1/10 their maximum speed. And that wasn't a good story either, apparently. So in July of 2004, the 9/11 Commission report came out with the final story that jets were scrambled not due to military problems, but to the FAA failures. These jets went in the wrong direction and still at the fraction of the speed. So that all this is really highly suspicious. And, they're claiming incredible incompetence and incredible coincidences. So these 19 hijackers also outfoxed several security systems. And a big thing the 9/11 Commission left out of the report is that the directors of the company responsible for security at United Airlines, Dulles Airport, and the World Trade Center included Wirt Walker, who was George W. Bush's first cousin and CEO of the company at that time, and Marvin Bush, who was George W. Bush's brother. Another amazing coincidence. Additionally, there were no Arabs on the flight manifest that were released, and the airlines have since refused to release passenger lists. So this is adding up to a pretty false story, really, in terms of being the fullest possible account and an exacting investigation. But it goes on. These hijackers performed expert aerial maneuvers, flying several hijacked planes into buildings. But it's been noted that hitting a building at 500 miles per hour in a 767 is pretty difficult to begin with. But the Washington Post reported aviation sources saying that the plane that hit the Pentagon was flown with extraordinary skill. I guess it was a high-speed dive of several thousand feet and a 330-degree turn. It almost turned completely around for whatever reason, and it hit the west wing of the Pentagon, which was nearly empty due to construction. The big problem with this is Hani Hanjour was supposed to have been the pilot, and he was known to be a terrible pilot, as the 9/11 Commission admits, but also the operation's most experienced pilot. He could not fly a Cessna, apparently. And he couldn't fly a Cessna, and the instructors wouldn't go up with him again. But yet he flew a 757 as if it was a fighter jet. A big question with the Pentagon, additionally, is whether or not there was 757 wreckage there. There are no 757 wreckage pieces in the photos, either outside the building or inside the building. There was an engine that was found that may have been from a missile, is much smaller than the engine from a 757. And Donald Rumsfeld did mention that a missile hit the building. The damage to the building overall is really questionable. And the FBI refuses to release videos that they confiscated from area cameras, including a gas station across the street, Pentagon cameras on the building, and so forth. Finally, these hijackers crashed one of these planes in Pennsylvania, but the big question is, did this plane crash or was it shot down? And the Pittsburgh Tribune Review reported that the aircraft debris was spread over an 8-mile distance. You can imagine that if a plane came down all, due to internal problems, it came down all at once, and it's doubtful that the debris would have bounced for 8 miles. On the other hand, if the plane was shot out of the air, and as witnesses said, debris rained out of the air, then certainly it might have spread over an 8-mile distance. Several major media sources reported that a shoot-down order was given 20 minutes before the crash. The 9/11 Commission said the order was not received until 30 minutes after the crash. That's a 50-minute unexplained difference. Major Daniel Nash, one of the fighter pilots who went to New York City, said he was told that an F-16 had shot down a plane in Pennsylvania. Witnesses saw a fighter jet. They heard explosions above, and there was a Vietnam veteran I saw who knows what a missile sounds like, said he heard a missile. To go on, this official conspiracy theory, per the 9/11 Commission report, says that these terrorists were acting on behalf of Osama bin Laden. This video confession that appears to prove that Osama bin Laden did do it and also contradicts his earlier statement that he didn't do it appears to be a fake, as the facial features are much different than previous pictures of Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden was, however, known to be a CIA asset during the Russian-Afghanistan war. This was reported very well in a 1998 article by MSNBC. He actually led a group called MAK during this Afghanistan war that was funded by the CIA, and that after the Afghanistan war evolved into something called Al-Qaeda. In July of 2001, Osama bin Laden was treated in an American hospital in Dubai and visited by a CIA agent. So the question is Osama bin Laden still a CIA asset? The 9/11 Commission would have us believe no other foreign or domestic agencies were involved, but it's been said that foreign agents were celebrating near the World Trade Center. They were arrested. Fox News had done a series of reports on them until the reporter from Fox was told this is not the story. There is evidence of Saudi funding. Both the LA Times said that 9/11 Commission was actually holding back evidence that Saudis had funded Al-Qaeda. Senator Bob Graham wrote in this book that Saudis had funded Al-Qaeda. There's a lot of evidence that Pakistan's ISI, which is like the CIA in Pakistan, was involved. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is supposedly the mastermind of 9/11, is linked to Pakistan's ISI and to Daniel Pearl's murder, the Wall Street Journal reporter. Finally, they say this all happened because of deep institutional failings within the U.S. government, and there's a lot of problems with that because no one was held accountable within the U.S. government. Many people were promoted. For me, what's really surprising is we had no clue at all in on September 11th, but 3 days later we knew everything. That's very surprising. And also, I think the recommendations made by the 9/11 Commission have not been taken seriously. So to wrap up this first part, I would say that the official conspiracy theory as presented by the 9/11 Commission report is false because the report does not, by a long shot, provide the fullest possible account of the events surrounding 9/11. It's also false because it omits or distorts many of the most important facts, apparently in an attempt to support predetermined conclusions. And it's false because the recommendations have not been taken seriously. So really, at this point, we're well on our way to saying the official conspiracy theory may be a bigger crime than the crimes of 9/11. And I don't think it's surprising to any of us that politicians lie to us. I'm sorry if there are politicians in the room, by the way. But we're not used to thinking about scientists lying to us. So the question is, will these government scientists who essentially work for the politicians, will they do an honest investigation, or did they do an honest investigation? So we'll look at the official conspiracy theory part two, which has to do with the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings. And there were three investigations related to this. The first was the American Society of Civil Engineers, led by Gene Corley. It was called by some a tourist trip. They had no access to steel samples or to blueprints. They were not allowed to solicit help from the public or even speak to the press. The next investigation was not an investigation by their own admission. FEMA called their team the Building Performance and Assessment Team, so theirs was an assessment. They did release a report in May of 2002 and had some good information in it, including the fact that only 4,000 gallons of jet fuel were available to feed the fires in the impact zone, and that was gone in a flash fire in 5 minutes. 5 months after the report came out, there was a gap of 5 months. The 9/11 families had pitched a fit and finally got an actual investigation started in October of 2002. This was the NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. They just released their report last year. They had 8 public meetings where info trickled out. They've created a 10,000-page report with 42 companion reports. And the surprising thing is it cost $20 million. That's surprising because we spent $40 million on the Clinton sex scandal. That's twice that. And there are no wars involved. We've actually spent 15,000 times that amount on the 9/11 wars. Finally, we need to remember that World Trade Center 7 has still not been explained. Their report is only for the towers. Let's talk about some important preliminary considerations. No tall steel frame buildings have ever collapsed from fire, but on 9/11 we're told there were 3, and the odds of that are very, very low. The steel evidence was destroyed, most of it. A few samples were saved, about 200. Despite outraged cries from the public and from fire experts. And like the 9/11 Commission report, a full investigation was not considered until 9/11 families demanded it. There are a lot of apparent conflicts of interest. Charles Thornton was on the top advisory committee. These are just a few I know. And the reason that's a conflict of interest is that his partner, Richard Tomasetti, was behind a decision to recycle the steel. So it seems to be a conflict of interest. The architectural firm Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, very closely related to Larry Silverstein, who made a lot of money off of the collapse of the buildings. This architectural firm also stood to make money because they were designing the new buildings, including one called the Freedom Tower, which in a sense is a conflict of interest because that almost assumes we know what happened. And then, again, most if not all the contractors depended on good government relations, so we have to keep those things in mind. In January of 2002, there's a couple things we should also keep in mind. Bill Manning, the editor of Fire Engineering Magazine, said, "The official investigation is a half-baked farce." He was also one of the people that called out to stop the destruction of the steel evidence. Dick Cheney had called Senate Leader Tom Daschle in that same month and asked him to limit the scope and overall review of what happened on 9/11 because it might draw resources from the war on terrorism. Tom Daschle didn't really believe that, so President Bush met with him privately and asked him to limit the investigation. In the scientific method, you begin with facts, and then you draw conclusions. In the political method, you begin with conclusions and you try and find facts. That also might be called anti-science. And that's really what the NIST World Trade Center team did. They started with predetermined conclusions, and they worked their way towards leading hypotheses. These are the terms they used, not predetermined conclusions, but definitely leading hypotheses. But you can see from some quotes, very early on, Shankar Nair was one of the contributors to the NIST report, one of the contractors, and he said, "Already there's near consensus as to the sequence of events that led to the collapse of the World Trade Center." That was barely a week after the collapse. Charles Thornton, again, talking to Carl Koch, said, "Carl, we all know what caused the collapse." Carl was the son of the man whose company erected the World Trade Center steel. So Shankar Nair and UL and definitely depend on good relations with the government, and they appeared to already know what they were going to say. One problem with that is there's been a progression of theories to explain the official fire-based story. The first one could be called the Towering Inferno theory, and this lasted surprisingly long. I think that probably is still lasting in a lot of minds. It's kind of a nuclear meltdown thing, just these insane temperatures and everything melted. There was also a column failure theory early, and the problem with that is that it requires a great deal of fireproofing to fall off in very extreme temperatures, almost Towering Inferno or higher temperatures. The theory that most experts or so-called experts clung to in order to support the official story was called the pancake theory. And this is where floors collapsed like records on a spindle. And finally, there's a new theory. It's the NIST's new theory. We'll see why they need a new theory. That talks about sagging floors pulling columns inward. It's, again, a column failure theory. In this case, a perimeter column failure theory. So I just want to review some of the early theories so you have an idea of how we got this far. The Towering Inferno theory was supported by a number of professional people. Henry Kaufman of USC stated, "The bottom line, in my opinion, is that the intense heat from the jet fuel fires melted the steel infrastructure." Hyman Brown, a professor from the University of Colorado, said, "Steel melts and 24,000 gallons of aviation fuel, jet fuel, I assume, melted the steel. Nothing is designed or will be designed to withstand that fire." James Glanz, a reporter from the New York Times, said the steel turned to licorice. And Chris Wise, who was some kind of structural engineer apparently, told the BBC that the columns would have melted and the floors would have melted. There was a lot of exaggeration of the fires, the temperatures, and column damage. Eduardo Causel from MIT, who did contribute to the NIST report, stated no building has or will resist this kind of fire. A couple of videos that have been shown on TV over and over again are probably still being shown on TV. One called The Anatomy of September 11th, and the other a NOVA video called How the Towers Fell, Exaggerated Temperatures. And the NOVA video said that two-thirds of the columns in the North Tower were severed. And the U.S. News and World Report just kind of parroted this sort of stuff. The NIST tests, unfortunately, the ones that did say something showed that temperatures were much lower, steel temperatures were much lower. So first of all, we have to look at these pictures and say, where's the fire? There's a building in Madrid that burned like a torch for 24 hours, half of that time totally out of control. You can be sure that it exceeded any fire resistance rating that it was given, but it did not suffer global collapse. Another very similar fire in October of 2004 in Venezuela burned for 17 hours and did not collapse. And that's the history. That's really, no buildings have ever collapsed, and there's been terrible fires in buildings. There were some statements made that made you wonder who would design a building for plane crashes, but forget the jet fuel fires. Everybody knows these buildings were designed for aircraft impacts, 707 impacts. Eduardo Causel again said that the World Trade Center buildings were designed to withstand these impacts, but were never designed for the massive explosions or the intense jet fuel fires that came next, a key design omission. And Loring Knobloch, the CEO of Underwriters Laboratories, wrote to me that the jet fuel fires were not reasonably foreseeable. And the question you have to ask is, how would the planes get to the buildings without jet fuel? The question, who would really design buildings like this? Not this person. This is John Skilling, the engineer who did design the World Trade Center towers. He had this to say 5 years before his death when he was asked if he considered the fires and the plane crashes, and he said, Our analysis indicated the biggest problem would be the fact that all the fuel would dump into the building. It would be a horrendous fire. A lot of people would be killed, he said. But the building structure would still be there. And this is in a book called City in the Sky, which is here in the library if you want to read it. The column failure theory never really held up, but the pancake theory did. And here's Carl Koch again describing it pretty well, what the most experts thought was the pancake theory. He said, I could see it in my mind's eye. The fire burned until the steel was weakened and the floors above collapsed, starting a chain reaction of gravity, floor falling upon floor, clunk, 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 the load gaining weight and momentum by the nanosecond, unstoppable. Once enough floors collapsed, the exterior walls and the core columns were no longer laterally supported and folded in. So essentially, we'll see pictures of this, but the floors collapsed like records on a spindle, and then they weren't laterally supported, and he said they folded in. The FEMA report also talked about this pancake type of collapse. Unfortunately, it was the pancake theory itself that collapsed. In August of 2004, Underwriters Laboratories tested models of the World Trade Center floors. I worked there at the time, of course not for this division. There was no floor collapse, and therefore there's no pancaking. NIST admits this in their report. The results established that this type of assembly was capable of sustaining a large gravity load without collapsing for a substantial period of time relative to the duration of the fires in any given location on September 11th. So the floors are not the problem. And I really think that all the supporters of the government theory were in a real pickle here because they had a bet on this. This was it. This was the theory. Before we get into looking at what NIST then came up with, we need to look at some original design claims for the buildings. These are all quotes from the Engineering News Record during the time the buildings were being designed. They said the World Trade Center towers would have an inherent capacity to resist unforeseen calamities. For the perimeter columns, live loads on these columns can be increased more than 2,000% before failure occurs. These were super strong, 100,000 PSI heat-treated perimeter columns. And they said one could cut away all the first-story columns on one side of the building and partway from the corners of the perpendicular sides, and the building could still withstand design live loads in 100-mile-per-hour wind from any direction. Remember that. The core, these massive core columns that actually formed a self-standing core, and around them 236 of these super strong perimeter columns, they're tied together with what are called spandrels, and they form this huge matrix. A lot of people talked about planes hitting the buildings being like poking a pencil through mosquito netting, and that's why, because it's this huge matrix mesh of super strong steel. And then the floors span between the core and the perimeter. Okay, so what did NIST end up saying? How do they end up describing to us how these buildings collapse? Well, they actually have two slightly different stories for the two towers, which doesn't help their case because we're trying to describe how three buildings all collapse from fire when it's never happened before. Three stories doesn't help us. But there are two stories. The two stories for the towers were generally the same, and they have these seven features. The aircraft severed a number of columns. Loads were redistributed. Insulation was damaged. Some floors began to sag. Sagging floors pulled exterior columns inward, causing them to buckle. Instability spread around the entire building perimeter. And then global collapse ensued. So we're going to look at this stuff, these steps one at a time. First step, we must ask how many columns were severed. The NIST now admits that only a small percentage of columns were severed. In the North Tower, there were only 14%, and the South Tower, only 15%. Of course, that's a lot less than the TV program that says two-thirds of the columns. But again, going back to the original design claims, one could cut away so many of the first-story columns, down where the load was much heavier, to the point of having more than 25% column loss and still not have a problem. So the difference between that and what actually was severed is 30 columns or more before we even have a problem exceeding design claims. For the second step, how much load was redistributed? NIST says loads on some columns were actually decreased by as much as 20%, and on other loads they were increased by as much as 25%. But again, since the original design claims were that live loads on the columns, on the perimeter columns especially, could be increased more than 2,000% before failure occurs, these columns should have had much more capacity. The third step is very important. This statement is very important by NIST. the insulation was sprayed on vermiculite, 3/4 inch thick, sprayed on vermiculite. And AST reports that the towers would not have collapsed under the combined effects of aircraft impact and subsequent multi-floor fires if the insulation had not been widely dislodged. So they're hanging their hat on that. That's the one thing they're trying to hold on to. They do go on to say then that dislodgement of thermal insulation could have occurred, which is good, because that, you know, that's the whole story now. But surely they performed extensive testing, since this is the whole story. Extensive testing they must have performed to prove this. So they actually devote one sentence in their 10,000-page report to the dislodgement of insulation. They say that an array of 0.3-inch diameter pellets moving at 350 miles an hour was able to strip insulation from some truss bars. Truss bars have to do with the floors. But we're talking about a column failure theory now, so we don't need to know about the floors. We need to know how exactly Boeing 767 transformed into an array of 0.3-inch pellets that could widely dislodge so much fireproofing from so many steel columns. We simply don't know on either count. NAST estimates some accelerations that might have been useful, but we really need to know what the forces were involved. Accelerations are one thing, but without masses and, you know, and the dimensions of the debris, we won't know anything. And you might remember the Warren Commission that used a magic bullet to help explain the assassination of JFK. The magic bullet traveled in many different directions. NAST now has an array of magic bullets. They're actually pretty slow-moving bullets, too, but to get around all of those perimeter columns, they really had to be some magic bullets. Step four said this: the floors began to sag, and there was some slight sagging visible in the NIST photos from the Underwriters Laboratory's tests of the floor models. But remember, those floor models were subjected to intense heat in furnaces. And we need to know how the sagging so dramatically changes the force applied to the columns at floor connections, because unsagged floors don't weigh more than sagged floors. NIST says there was a shear force of 14,000 PSI that was applied to the perimeter columns. But we already know that the perimeter columns were rated at 100,000 PSI and they had incredible overcapacity. And also the weld plate connections were rated at 90,000 PSI. Now we come to the actual first failure of the building, and that is sagging floors pulled exterior columns inward. This is the initiation of collapse. Some experts have already pointed out that the core columns cannot pull the exterior columns in via the floor. These are British engineers. But we need to know how many columns buckled first to initiate all this. Was it more than the difference between the 15% that the aircraft severed and the greater than 25% that the original design claim said was okay? Was it more than 30 columns? And how did this happen? Well, even if we did strip all the insulation away, we'd need some extreme temperatures for this to happen. And we're talking steel temperatures, not air temperatures. And it's known that the temperature of protected steel, even in a testing furnace brought and held above 1,000 degrees Celsius, requires 2 hours to reach 600 degrees Celsius. A lot of people have talked about 600, 650 Celsius because that, they say, is the temperature that steel loses half its strength. And remember, the South Tower collapsed in only 56 minutes. NIST did one test that provided some good information on those 200 samples we talked about that weren't recycled. Only three of them showed temperatures in a paint deformation test that were higher than 500 degrees Fahrenheit. They did a second test that just said that no temperatures were above 600 C, but they might have said no temperatures were above 1,000,000 C. That's a one-sided statement. They didn't say that any of the temperatures reached 499 or 599. But the paint test actually told us something. Less than 2% of those columns reached 500 degrees Fahrenheit. A couple of facts that make us wonder about these extreme temperatures is that people in the impact zones were clearly not experiencing high temperatures. Some of them escaped unharmed. Firefighters were working in the impact zones right up to the point of collapse, and some of them called in and said the fires were small and manageable. In one building, there were only two small pockets of fire. Those people died, of course. We can calculate how hot the steel might have become because we know how much fuel there was. We know how much office furnishings there were. And from that, we can calculate the energy available to raise the temperature of all the materials in the impact zone. And using the masses and specific heats for the materials, a temperature can be calculated. This is a 310-degree temperature, Celsius, or only 590 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's using a lot of assumptions. No gases escaped. There's no conduction of steel, heat through the steel, and steel has a very high thermal conductivity. We had infinite time for all this to happen. Of course, those assumptions are wrong, so you might consider that those temperatures are probably just maximum temperatures. That's probably a maximum temperature that the steel saw, and that does match with the paint test. I'd like to review some of these steel temperatures that have been discussed and will be discussed, just so you keep them in mind. On the far left is the paint test that NAST did. 500 degrees is what less than 2% of the steel despite pre-collapse exposure to fire. This was steel that had been exposed to fire in the impact zones. Had seen only 2% had seen 500 degrees Fahrenheit. And the calculation is just slightly above that. That matches well. Steel at half strength that a lot of so-called experts have talked about, that's about 1,200 Fahrenheit. Steel is forged, as a rule, at about 1,800 Fahrenheit. ASTM E119 is the standard for fire resistance testing of steel and floor assemblies. We'll talk about that in a minute. And the TV program talked about 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, and steel melts at about 2,800 degrees Fahrenheit. The tests and the calculations point to much lower temperatures than would be needed to soften or melt steel. Another question, and this is kind of where I come in, was the steel tested for fire resistance, as all buildings have to have done? NIST said they found no documents, either for the steel tests or for Skilling's jet fuel analysis, which appears very convenient for them. And Underwriters Laboratories CEO, Loring Knobloch, told me that UL had tested the steel to the New York City code, which requires 3 hours of fire resistance for columns. Now that I've made a public statement about it, or did a year and a half ago, UL has said there's no evidence that any firm tested the steel. Something that warms my heart, though, is an IUSB student investigation. They ran a couple of articles up in South Bend in their student newspaper on 9/11 Truth, and one they were trying to follow up on my story because I'm from South Bend. And they called the Port Authority in New York, who said no records exist. They called the Chamber of Commerce in New York, who said those records just happened to come up missing. And again, UL and other experts are not saying much now. Let's look at the test again. If they had been tested for fire resistance, and I was told they were, they would have undergone a test similar to this, if not this very test. ASTM U119 time temperature curve is what is followed by a furnace with steel components or floor assemblies within the furnace. So the temperature is raised to about 2,000 degrees and held for hours. And they check to see if there's any failure of the components within in terms of load-bearing capability. There is another test. UL has a version of this where they actually raise the temperature more dramatically, higher, right up to 2,000, and then level it off more. But it's essentially the same test. So just because, you know, this lecture is a little bit about me as a whistleblower, I'll tell you a little bit more about what UL said to me and to others about testing the World Trade Center steel. And these are written statements that I have from the top managers at UL. We tested the steel with all the required fireproofing on, and it did beautifully. As we do not do follow-up service on this kind of product, we can give an opinion only on the test sample, which was indeed properly coded. We tested the code requirements, and the steel clearly met those requirements, New York City code requirements, and exceeded them. And of course, now UL says there's no evidence that anyone tested the steel. I had a number of conversations and written communications with quite a few managers. I really wasn't trying to take this company down or anything. They're a good company for the most part. I'm not so happy with the recent management, but I had quite a few conversations and written communications, but these are some of them that are kind of highlights, and we'll go through just briefly again the timeline that we're talking about here. In September of 2001, shortly after the attacks, is when Loring Nabok came to our South Bend location and told us that UL, all of us, that UL had certified the steel. In November of 2003, I'd learned a few more things about 9/11 and about government lying and so forth. So I asked Nabok in writing about UL's involvement, and he responded in December, confirming these details. In August 2004, again, the UL performed tests of the World Trade Center floor assemblies, and within a week of that, Loring Nabok resigned suddenly. In October of 2004, NIST released what was to be their final update on their report. The report was supposed to come out in December, 2 months later. After reading that report, I sent NIST's Frank Gale, who did the paint deformation test, a message asking for clarification, and shortly thereafter, I lost my job. I did ask the fire protection manager also that year if he would release make a public news release on this. Never happened. So the question for me and for you is the company that calls itself our public safety guardian lying to us about the most important safety issue of our lives? But that's all I have to say about my story, and we'll continue with NIST's story. But we'll review here where we've come. To believe this story so far, we need a Boeing 767 to transform into an array of magic bullets that widely dislodge the fireproofing from at least 30 columns without any test results to support either of these contentions. We then need the same columns to be heated more than 1,000 degrees, actually more over 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit, above what the test results show are present. Then, matching up precisely with a few floors that apparently sagged a little bit, we need these columns to buckle all at once inward in an unknown way to initiate the collapse sequence. And we also need to believe that UL is telling us the truth now. And I, for my part, I think all this is very hard to believe so far, but we do have more to go. You have to really want it, I'll say. The sixth step of NASD's story is that instability spread around the entire building perimeter. But we know that in the North Tower, the transmission antenna on top fell first. That indicates the core actually gave way first. The buildings fell at nearly free fall speed. A steel structure, generally speaking, does not collapse suddenly when attacked by fire. There are unmistakable warning signs, namely large deformations. That is, these buildings would, if they're softening and giving way, they're going to bend, they're going to tilt, sway, they're not going to collapse straight down. But of course, that's what they did. Finally, NAST gives up. They get us to that initiation of collapse, which is really just one step. And then they say global collapse ensued, which is a chilling statement. A lot of questions from engineering and physics professors within our group, though. For example, how did the top of the South Tower, which had started to tilt a little bit, just turn into dust in midair instead of falling alongside of the building? What about resistance of the floors below? If these floors each cause only half a second of hesitation, we would need another 40 seconds for the buildings to fall. And these buildings had stood up for 30 years. What about the observed squibs? Squibs are horizontally ejected puffs of smoke. They're sometimes called demolition squibs. And they were ejected far below the collapsed front. What about the large pools of molten metal observed in basement areas of all three buildings? And this is like algebra class in high school where they tell you to forget everything you just heard. There actually was molten metal, pools of it. We just know it wasn't from jet fuel. Could have happened from advanced demolition techniques. How could any of this happen the way NIST says it does? Well, it could happen in a computer model because that's what they did. The parameters they originally considered realistic to input into this computer model were discarded because computer results did not compare to observed events. These are their words, and I'm not kidding you. More severe parameters were substituted until the animations gave the desired results. And again, NIST will not release thousands of photos and video, real photos and video. They're holding them. Finally, the official conspiracy theory per the NIST World Trade Center report is false because they did not explain by any stretch of the imagination why and how the Twin Towers collapsed, and of course they haven't talked about World Trade Center 7 yet. They omitted or distorted many important facts, including original design claims, John Skilling's analysis of the fires, resistance from the floors, the antenna moving first, pools of molten metal, none of these things they talked about, results of their physical tests they ignored. The scholars group is calling for an examination of the demolition hypothesis, within which the government investigations have all ignored. There are a lot of reasons for this. Some include the demolition squib seen ejected from floors far below the impact zone, the upper floors turning to powder in midair, the molten pools of metal, the site being cleaned up by a company called Control Demolition, Inc., many reports of explosions and flashes of light, and the fact that all of these buildings exhibited the characteristics of controlled demolition. You may know that shortly after 9/11, there were oral histories taken of all the firemen, paramedics, policemen. Those were held by the mayor of New York for 4 years. He wouldn't release them. He just released them in August of 2005. We'll go through some of those. Paramedic Daniel Rivera said, "Did you ever see professional demolition where they set the charges on certain floors? And then you hear pop, pop, pop. I thought it was that." Witness Timothy Burke said the building popped lower than the fire. I was going, "Oh my God, there's a secondary device because of the way the building popped. I thought it was an explosion." Firefighter Edward Caccia actually gave it a lower floor, not the floor where the plane hit. "We originally thought there was like an internal detonation, explosives." Assistant Commissioner Stephen Gregory said, "I thought that I saw low-level flashes at the lower level of the building, you know, like when they demolish a building." A few more. Firefighter Richard Banasicki said there was just an explosion. It seemed like on television when they blow up these buildings. It seemed like it was going all around like a belt, all these explosions. Deputy Commissioner Thomas Fitzpatrick said it looked like sparkling around one specific layer of the building. "My initial reaction was that this was exactly the way it looks when they show you those implosions on TV." Battalion Chief Brian Dixon said the lowest floor of the fire in the South Tower actually looked like someone had planted explosives all around it because everything blew out on the one floor. And firefighter Kenneth Rogers said there was an explosion in the South Tower. "I kept watching floor after floor after floor. It looked like a synchronized, deliberate kind of thing." So those are the witnesses. I'd like to talk about the 47-story World Trade Center tower, even though NIST has not. It would have been the tallest building in 33 states. Indiana, 10 years ago, built one just 2 stories taller, 49 stories. It collapsed in 6.6 seconds. And Larry Silverstein, the leaseholder for all three buildings, said, "Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it because there's so much loss of life," he said that day. And so the fire commander and himself, they decided to pull it. And pull means, it means to demolish a building. So they pulled it. This was on a PBS video. It takes weeks to plan and implement a controlled demolition. Finally, I'd like to end on a positive note and say it's not too late. I believe we can end these wars and this assault on our country. We just need to face the fact that the official conspiracy theory is false, and we need to demand real answers.
You've been listening to 9/11, A Hoosier Whistleblower Examines the Official Conspiracy Theory, featuring Kevin Ryan, a chemist and former site manager at Underwriters Laboratories in South Bend, allegedly fired for questioning discrepancies between UL's test results on steel components from the World Trade Center and the official account of the building's collapse. Ryan is a representative of Scholars for 9/11 Truth online at st911.org. This program was recorded on location for WFHB at the Monroe County Public Library on Wednesday, March 15th, 2006, for this weekly lecture series, Standing Room Only, amplifying voices not adequately represented in mainstream media. Here on Community Radio, WFHB.